to anyone whose garden has been turned into a bug house or bird latrine, but the sycamore is part of the natural economy of the garden. For many, the sycamore seems too generous a tree altogether. It disturbs their sense of proportion, and even seems to uncover lurking puritanical anxieties about excess. It's the tree of profusion. Too much sap, too many leaves, too many sycamores, in fact. At every turn, its health and vigour count against it. Sycamore wood is as hard as oak, but far less sought after. No matter that some has a wavy grain, ideal for making into violins, guitars and harps. In general, it's seen as cheap and cheerful. A good choice for rolling pins and breadboards, because the light silky texture looks smooth and bright and fresh in the kitchen, as well as being easy to clean. But rolling pins don't command the respect afforded to the towering masts of a tall ship, or the fine rich finish of a Chippendale chair. As a wood that's never in short supply, sycamore lacks rarity value. In fact, a powerful, pervasive objection to the sycamore is that it's rather common. Sycamores spring up everywhere, spreading rapidly because of the distinctive propeller-like seeds. The little transparent boomerangs seem eager to fly off the tree, gliding with every gust and eddy, racing to see which can fly furthest. The seedlings sprout easily, and don't seem to mind much whether they've found a home on the edge of a well-groomed lawn or right in the middle of a lovingly tended rose bed. These perky little shoots are usually treated as weeds and yanked out of the soil before they can get their roots down. The sycamore is, indeed, one of the few trees to feature in the brilliant book on weeds by Richard Mabey, who points to another of its apparently off-putting features. It is a foreigner. Unlike oak, yew, rowan or willow, the sycamore is widely regarded as a non-native species, introduced to Britain in the late 15th century. This probably wouldn't much matter were it not for the sycamore's astonishing ability to multiply. Rapid in growth, rapid in expansion, the sycamore strikes many as an enemy invader, driving out our poor native trees, depriving our wildflowers of light with its thick canopy of flourishing leaves. It's the grey squirrel of the vegetable world. No sooner here than it was everywhere. Except that there's a possibility that it's a native after all. In Christchurch Cathedral in Oxford, the 13th century shrine of St. Frideswide has carvings of sycamore leaves, which has led to further debate over the sycamore's alien status. Whether the medieval sculptor had particular local trees in mind when adorning the tomb is rather hard to judge, however, and the five-pointed leaf may well have been chosen primarily for reasons of Christian symbolism. But even if sycamores have only been growing in Britain since Tudor times, they are hardly recent arrivals. Descent through five centuries would provide a respectable enough pedigree for most of the people who mind about such things. And if the sycamore is really such an aggressive expansionist, how have all those other trees managed to survive here for so long? Matters of origin are, in any case, subject to fashion. In the 19th century, it was exotic imports that were highly prized, as the horticulturalist John Loudon noticed. No residence in the modern style can have a claim to be considered as laid out in good taste, in which all the trees and shrubs are not either foreign or improved varieties of indigenous ones. Homegrown or imported, the sycamore's adaptable nature means that it will always be quick to rush in where other trees fear to tread. It can withstand the exhaust fumes of the inner city, or the bracing, salt-saturated air of northern coastlines. It's been recognised as a good bet for quick coverage since the 60s, when motorways began to zip up the landscape. Sycamores grew quickly and reliably, taking the hard edges off the new roads and housing estates, cushioning children's playgrounds with greenery. Undaunted by any environment, it seems, the sycamore is one of the world's most travelled trees. When Apollo 14 blasted off in 1971, one of the astronauts, Stuart Roosa, took some seeds with him on the mission to see if they would be affected. After orbiting the moon 34 times, the seeds landed back on Earth to be monitored by NASA scientists. 40 years later, moon sycamores are still flourishing across the USA, as living testaments to the courage and ingenuity of mankind, and to the remarkable resilience of this supposedly common tree. There is, in fact, something inspirational about the apparent ordinariness of the sycamore. In Ireland, the famous wishing tree of Mount Rath was an old sycamore, whose cracked, crazy paving of a trunk proved irresistible to visitors nursing secret hopes and desires. For years, people came to make a wish, driving it home with coins and nails until the tree shone like an elderly, silver-scaled dragon, too weighed down with everyone's cares to be able to get airborne again. Unfortunately, all that human expectation eventually killed the tree. In one of Seamus Heaney's elegies for his mother, he imagines her as a dead wishing tree. But instead of conveying despair, the old tree unexpectedly sails off to heaven, sloughing off all the nails and coins in a marvellous vision of uplift and consolation. This is very much a tree capable of eliciting tears of joy, rather than just remaining a green thing in the way. The sycamore has strong biblical associations, having been climbed by the unpopular tax collector Zacchaeus when he wanted to see Jesus without being seen by the crowd. In fact, the biblical sycamore was probably a mulberry fig, but in its journey through languages, the Middle Eastern Ficus sycamorus became the English sycamore. Later appearances in literature may therefore carry traces of biblical meaning. When Wordsworth rests under a sycamore near Tintern Abbey, or Walton chooses it for a contemplative spot in The Complete Angler, the detail may hint at unexpected glimpses of the divine. Whether or not either had Zacchaeus in mind, they both describe the sycamore as dark. This may reflect the other side of the etymological confusion, which led to sycamores being linked to fig leaves and then to the fall of man. But it seems more likely that they were really thinking about shade. For one of the most enduring aspects of the sycamore is its sun-blocker foliage. Those great clumps of grass-green leaves, sprouting like huge heads of broccoli on their tall, elegantly spreading trunks, cast motley shadows over sunlit lawns. John Clare worked on a farm before becoming a poet, and when he wanted to evoke a blistering heatwave, he described a sheep shearing pen, where elm and sycamore shut out the sun. For those faced with the strenuous tasks of clipping sheep or cutting hay, the scorching sun was exhausting, and so the dark sycamore acted as a great natural parasol, protecting shepherds and livestock. The shade of a full-leaf sycamore was a haven from hard, relentless labour, and all the more welcome for being commonplace. In the small Dorsetshire village of Tolpuddle, the old sycamore on the village green still stands as a memorial to the agricultural workers who gathered under its shady branches in 1834. They were in need not just of a rest, but of a pay rise, since their wages had been severely reduced, leaving them unable to support their families. When they agreed to band together and demand a fair wage, they were convicted of swearing an illegal oath and transported to Australia. Public outrage over the case meant that eventually the Tolpuddle martyrs were pardoned and allowed to return home. The fat old sycamore at Tolpuddle became a site of pilgrimage for those celebrating the foundations of the trade union movement. It's another symbol of hope for those whose lives have not been easy. But, as so often with this oddly divisive tree, this aspect of its meaning has proved more welcome to some than to others. Whatever the hard reality of agricultural labour, the image of a flourishing tree on the village green is part of the old pastoral ideal of eternal summer, where work, sweat, and poverty have no place. And this gives us fresh insight into the annual aggravation of those leaves on the line. Perhaps underlying the annoyance of being late for work is some lingering dream of endless summer holidays, all innocent of alarm clocks and electronic diaries. Leaves on the line is an adult equivalent of back to school, that ominous signal of returning routines, demands, and uniformity. It's a reminder of shortening days and dwindling temperatures, of disappearing sandals and things closing down. No wonder a delayed train seemed the final straw.
The Meaning of Trees, The Sycamore, was presented by Professor Fiona Stafford, produced by Turan Ali, and it was a Boner Broadcasting production for BBC Radio 3. It's coming up to 10 past 11, and joining me here in the studio, ready to take you through to 1 o'clock, Lopa Qatari with this week's World on 3. Lopa.
Thank you, Jonathan. And we are late on tonight because I believe that even heavenly angels don't run on time.
Performance of Handel's Messiah from Cardiff.
So, welcome to a slightly later than usual World on 3 with me, Lopa Qatari. And in fact, my last World on 3 for the year. So I hope you allow me the indulgence of playing music from some of my favourite albums of 2012. And we're going to be mixing it up with a few previously unaired highlights from this year's WOMAD Festival, artists who played on the Radio 3 stage, and also some of the other groups who made the weekend so memorable. But I thought that we'd start the programme tonight with a tribute to the late great Pandit Ravi Shankar, who died on Tuesday at the age of 92. I'm going to play a piece from his album, his last recording, done just last year at his home in California. Shankar says it was the result of just fooling around at home, and he had a lot of fun. The album is The Living Room Sessions, and this is Rag Gedra. Thank you. Ravi Shankar with Tanmoy Bose playing Rag Kedra from his album The Living Room Sessions, just recorded earlier last year. And he passed away in hospital after undergoing heart surgery in America earlier this week. Well, I'm really pleased to say that Viram Jasani of Asian Music Circuit is here in the studio with me on this cold and windy Friday night to share with us some of his personal recollections of the great man. Viram, a very, very warm welcome to you, and thank you for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Viram, Ravi Shankar, a life well lived, but still a very sad moment, not just for India, but for music as a whole.
Absolutely. He was one of the last remaining connections to what we in India consider to be the golden age of Indian music, the 40s and 50s. And not many people from that era left now. In fact, he was probably the last one. So it's a big, big loss. And what a great contribution he made. It's just irreplaceable.
It is very much that he seemed to have been the right person in the right place at the right time.
I think he was definitely the right person. There were other musicians around at the time, but somehow he was able to capture people's imagination, and he was the perfect bridge, if you like, between Indian music and Indian culture and Western appreciation and interest in Indian music.
Because, not just that sort of dialogue between the East and the West, you know, communicating Indian classic music, but in a sense, I guess, making Indians themselves aware that it has greater appeal.
Absolutely. I think you're very, very right in raising that point. I suppose in India, Indian classical music is just like classical music here. Not everybody loves it. And in India, sometimes classical music is often frowned upon. And the reason why that's the case is because it's totally absorbing. Mm. It takes you away from your more mundane duties in life of raising a family and giving them an education and earning a living. So, and the reason for that is that classical music, it requires a lot of dedication, years and years of practice, and Ravi Shankar is an example of that and what you can achieve if you do it. And I think he probably gave an example to the more conservative sectors of Indian society that actually music is worthwhile pursuing.
Well, yes, that it has a greater appeal. I mean, it's that sort of shaking off some of the cobwebs and the and perhaps the sort of fuddy-duddy image of Indian classical music. He made it more accessible.
Oh, completely. But that had another side to it also, that even people who didn't appreciate the music wanted to be at his concert.
Now, you've chosen quite a bit of the music that we're going to play tonight from Ravi Shankar. What are we going to play next? And what does it mean to you, Viram?
Well, the next piece of music is from his very first LP, and from a rag called Jog. I grew up in England in the 50s, and this actually meant everything to me as when I was a schoolboy, rushing home from school and then putting on this LP, switching off the lights, and then dreaming about being a sitar player like Ravi Shankar, or occasionally tuning my tabla to this pitch and then practicing with the record. But essentially, it was an iconic part of my life. And what's particularly interesting about the first section is his tremendous lyricism in playing in the lower register of the sitar. He did that rarely later on in his career, but in those days it was absolutely an example of his roots in traditional Drupad, in singing, and it's very beautiful. Another thing I might just point out, if you don't mind, is the exquisite sitar that he had. And as you will hear, sometimes when he plays a phrase, all the sympathetic strings start vibrating and tingling. It's like being in fairyland.
So here we have Ravi Shankar playing Rag Jog and taking us back in many respects to the roots of sitar playing, which was to mimic the beauty of the voice. Thank you. See what you mean there, Vera, about those beautiful bass notes. That's fantastic. That's from his first ever recording in 1956, is that right?
57, I think, 57. Came out. And I think it came out just at the time he had given his first ever concert in London, which I went to as a young teenager. And I was 12 years old when I went to that concert. And it was at Friend's House in Euston. The place was packed. And he had this wonderful tabla player, Chaturlal, playing with him. And, of course, he had the whole audience in his hands. A fantastically exciting and evocative concert. So for me, you see, this is absolutely Indian culture. And I was very fortunate to have been brought up with that. But he also gave another concert at the Royal Festival Hall, I think it was a year later. And all the tickets were sold by the time I got there, and I couldn't buy a ticket. And I remember sitting on the steps in the Royal Festival Hall, crying my eyes out because I couldn't get a ticket. And I told him about that later on when we produced his concerts. And I said, I couldn't get a ticket then, but today I'm producing your concerts. So we had a little giggle about that. And interestingly, he was brought over to England, first of all, by an organization called the Asian Music Circle. And the last organization, I think, to have produced his major tours here was, of course, the Asian Music Circuit.
It has a nice kind of circularity to it.
Absolutely.
But he actually got interested in playing the sitar while he was living in France, is that right?
Yes, that's the amazing thing, actually, that he was with his brother's dance troupe and he was playing various instruments as an accompanist and also dancing. And it's said that he actually got interested in traditional Indian music while living in Paris. And I find that very interesting because that's how I got interested in Indian music living in London. So I can I feel very sympathetic towards that. But of course, his roots are very, very well founded in Indian tradition. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget the last year when we brought a group of priests from Bangalore to do Vedic recitations here. We actually had a tour of Vedic recital, and Panditji actually came to the London concert, and he was so deeply involved with that Sanskrit recitation, and he was so grateful to the AMC for bringing these people over. Very, very rooted in traditional Indian culture.
Well, let's hear that the final part of that first recording of Rag Jog.
Thank you.
Wow, intense and passionate. Ravi Shankar there in one of his first recordings in 57. And here to share some of his memories of this great man is Viram Jasani of Asia Music Circuit. Viram, what command of rhythm he had.
Absolutely. I was going to say, actually, that little piece epitomises his character. He was full of fun, full of life. And that all came out in his music, you know, apart from the depth of his feelings and his soul. And what you're absolutely right, his command of rhythm was just phenomenal. And that, I think, was one of the hallmarks of his style. People used to criticize him by saying that, well, he diluted the traditional way of playing a full rag just to suit the Western audiences and make himself popular. Well, I don't actually agree with that view. You have to make the music accessible, and you couldn't have got a better person than Ravi Shankar to do that, because he could understand both sides of the story. And as far as sitar playing is concerned, you know, you play the sitar with two hands, the right and the left. Of course, they've both got to be very coordinated. And my personal view is that Ravi Shankar was very much of a right-hand man. Mm. And the right hand is the hand that you pluck the wires with, and that's the one that you create all the rhythm on. Whereas the left hand is the one that's manipulating the string, playing the melody. So that controls the lyricism of your music.
And maybe that came partly from the fact that he grew up actually as a dancer. So that whole rhythmic element is very much the way in which he heard music.
I think you're absolutely right. That must have had a big influence on him. Plus, of course, his love for South Indian culture and South Indian music, which is very, very rhythm-orientated. And I'm told, and I understand, that he actually studied South Indian rhythm in order to master his control on the sitar, which is very interesting. The other thing that I would say, that in spite of all of this and making the music very fun, he was still very traditional. The joystick was always there. And I think that's wonderful. But that also gave Western audiences the impression that without the joystick, you couldn't do anything that was Indian. You know, so you could have a few drinks and put on your kippah tie and bell-bottom trousers.
And purify it all with some incense.
Exactly, and get rid of all your evils, you see.
But he is quite a remarkable musician, given that he really didn't come from any music lineage. I mean, great sort of artistic family in many respects. But his brother, the dancer, and his father, a teacher of Sanskrit. But not this great dynasty, this line of artists, of musicians.
I think one gets the impression that anything he would have done, he would have been great at. Mm. He happened to have taken the sitar up, but he might have been a wonderful dancer. When I look at him in his early photographs, he's a very sort of Nijinsky kind of character, you know, a very powerful presence. And his height and his physique was absolutely perfect for a Kathak dancer. So I could see him being brilliant at that. But of course, he became one of the world's greatest sitarists.
Well, this next piece we're going to play, which is Hey Nath. I mean, Ravi Shankar did collaborate with many people. He had a lot of influences and was influenced by many artists in jazz and obviously the Beatles. So
well, I think, you see, that was his characteristic, that he had a very eclectic taste. He was interested in other things. He didn't necessarily make that an influence on his own music, as I said, that he always kept his roots in traditional music firmly there. But to collaborate, to find new ways of expression was very much part of his psyche. And I think those sort of collaborative movements helped lots of other musicians living in this country. It opened the doors for so many people, including myself, you know, to get opportunities to play with jazz and rock and so on.
And this is from a collection that was put together by George Harrison, is that right?
Exactly. This is, yes. Let's hear it. Thank you.
Dante. हम पर कृपा कीजिए दूर कर अंधकार ज्ञान का आलोक दीजिए हिंसा द्वेष लोभ क्रोध हमसे छीन मन में प्रेम शांति भर दीजिए हे नाथ हम पर कृपा कीजिए अंधकार ज्ञान का आलोक दीजिए हे नाथ हम पर कृपा कीजिए हिंसा द्वेष लोभ क्रोध हमसे छीन लीजिए हिंसा द्वेष लोभ क्रोध हमसे छीन लीजिए मन में प्रेम शांति भर दीजिए मन में प्रेम शांति भर दीजिए हे नाथ हम पर कृपा कीजिए हे नाथ कृपा कीजिए हे नाथ कृपा कीजिए हे नाथ कृपा कीजिए
Hey Nath from Ravi in Celebration, a compilation put together by George Harrison. Viram, we don't often get to hear Ravi Shankar's voice, and that was him singing at the beginning there, wasn't it?
That's right, that's right. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Absolutely wonderful. Now tell me about the heady days of the 60s.
Heady days of the 60s. Well, the question is, do I remember much of it?
The heady, foggy days of the 60s.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the wonderful things that he did was without destroying traditions. He opened the doors for so many young Indian musicians who were living in the UK and in America, people like me, to do little bits and pieces of performance and work in various places. And that's all because people were listening to his sitar and they wanted the sitar sound. They wanted it in background music to films and radio plays. They wanted it in jingles for advertising and so on. And everybody just loved that sitar twang, you know. And it was very amusing how they would go about trying to get it and give you the atmosphere. The other amusing thing was that they watched Ravi Shankar lighting these joysticks. So they thought that any Indian musician who came into the studio just to play 30 seconds for an advertisement needed that atmosphere, so they would fill the studio with joysticks. So, you know, on one occasion, I decided to tell them that joysticks wasn't enough. And so they said, well, would you like some whiskey? So I said, yes. And they brought out a bottle of whiskey. And after a couple of bottles of whiskey and some joysticks, we were all very far out, in the, to use the expression of the day. Thanks to Ravi.
But he did work with some extraordinary people, though, didn't he? I mean,
yeah.
He taught John Coltrane for a while. In fact, him and Alice called their son Ravi after Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, it? Absolutely. I mean, his influence was really very wide, and I'm not sure. I can't say for certain that it changed people's music fundamentally, but to some extent it must have done. In the case of people like Coltrane, it would have changed his view on improvising. And he would have had to think about how Indians improvise listening to Ravi Shankar and whether he could use some of that technique in his own music. Other people simply wanted the sound. And the drone particularly was very popular to use. But collaborations with jazz and so on. But, you know, the understanding level was developing slowly. I mean, a classic example is his famous concert for the Bangladesh, the Bangladesh concert, where he and Ali Akbar Khan spent a couple of minutes tuning up, and the audience started clapping when he paused. And that is a reflection of his humour, that, you know, I hope you enjoy the music as much as you enjoyed our tuning. So, you know, all of that was helping to create a great awareness of Indian music.
Where do you think his genius lay?
His genius is, what is genius? But I think he was just a phenomenally talented person. He could, as I said, touch anything and he would be great at it. Tremendous sense of aesthetics, very creative. He could turn something new out of anything, you know. And that's why I chose a couple of these tracks, because they are fundamentally Indian music, but the application in different contexts is really remarkable. And that's what I think. He's a very creative man.
Now, he met up with Yehudi Menuhin in the sort of 50s and 60s, and he worked quite closely with him, didn't he?
Well, Menuhin was the person who brought Indian music, in a sense, to the West. In fact, he brought Ravi Shankar's guru bhai, Ali Akbar Khan, who was the son of Alauddin Khan, and they were both learning from Alauddin Khan. And Ali Akbar Khan came to UK before Ravi Shankar, and Yehudi Menuhin brought him first. And I went to that concert too at the friend's house. Wonderful. So Yehudi Menuhin had a very close association with Indian culture. He was very much into yoga, into Indian philosophy, and then into music. So that understanding was very close.
Well, this piece we're going to hear is the two of them playing together, Ravi Shankar and Yehudi Menuhin.
Yeah.
And it's from a recording, I believe, from 1966.
Yeah.
And a piece that is Swara Kakali. classic and classical call and response, I guess you could call that, Yehudi Menuhin and Ravi Shankar. Viram, final thoughts from you, final memories.
Well, I think one of the wonderful characteristics of Ravi Shankar was his humanity. And also, I would say that he was a very, very shrewd and clever man. He knew exactly what was happening all over the world in the field of Indian music, so he kept his ear very much to the ground. So he knew who were the people involved and what they were doing. And he had heard that I played the sitar, for example. And so one day he said, I'd like to hear you. And he gave me the chance to play for him just in a one-to-one meeting. And I played for about an hour and a half for him. And he was so encouraging. Not many people of his stature and fame would give you the time of the day just like that. But that's his humanity, you see, and I'll never forget that. I believe you're going to round off the evening with...
Well, yes, we're going to play one final piece at the end of the programme, Rag Kamaj, that he recorded probably in the 60s. I guess you could say from his prime, but he had a prime that went on for decades.
It's unbelievable. I heard a recording of him playing last year in India, and it was just... You know, as if he was still 30 years younger, 40 years younger. The energy. You asked me what was part of his genius. I think the energy is certainly part of that. Relentless.
Viram, thank you very much for coming into the studio tonight and sharing with us some of your memories of the great Ravi Shankar.
Thank you.
Tribute there to the late Pandit Ravi Shankar, who passed away this week and leaves behind an undeniable legacy. You're listening to World on Three with me, Lopa Kotari. And so we continue tonight's programme with a look back at some of the magical moments of music from this year, with previously unaired highlights from this year's WOMAD Festival in Charlton Park and tracks from some of the albums that made it into my top 10. And I start with a captivating band from the mangrove wetlands of the Solomon Islands, Narasirato. They seem to be everywhere this summer, popping up by the BT River of Music and WOMAD and who knows where else. Well, in February, when it was just about as cold as it is now, I found myself willfully hanging out in a pedestrian subway, the Joe Strummer subway, under the Marylebone flyover in London, to be exact. And the venue was Kiosk One, home of the Subway Gallery, run by photographer, music adventurer Jason Mayle. Now, how Jason met the 16-piece bamboo band from the South Pacific, toured with them and brought out two albums is another story. But for now, let me just say the second album, Waratu, is beautiful. It loosely translates as the little seed of goodness in everything, which is pretty much how they see life and around which their belief system is built. It's also great music to be greeted by as you walk under a major road in the freezing cold. Adamant-style drumming from Solomon Islands, Narasirato and Mato.
You see me there, well, I ain't no fool. I'm one smart Frenchman, never been to school. Want to get somewhere in a Creole town? You stop and let me show you your way around. You let the bon ton roule. You let the mule poule. Now don't you be no poule. You let the bon ton roule. I got a Creole girl. She's one fine dish. But she's got ways like the old crawfish. She don't do nothing but race and all night. But when it comes to loving, she's a much all right. We let the bon ton roule. We let the mule poule. Now don't you be no poule. We let the bon ton roule. You want to have yourself some real fine fun? Go down in Louisiana and you get you one. You find them cutting cane all down the line. I've got a cotton picker, she's a really fine. We let the bon ton roule. We let the mule poule. Now don't you be no poule. We let the bon ton roule. Church bazaar or the baseball game, at the French la la, it's all the same. If you want to have fun, now you got to go way out in the country to the Zydeco. And let the bon ton roule. And let the mule poule. Now don't you be no poule. You let the bon ton roule.
Bon ton roule, a good time dance indeed. Clarence Garlow was a bit of a pioneer and brought the music of New Orleans to the wider American public. It's on the Fab 2 CD compilation on Union Square. It's called New Orleans Blues, Soul and Jazz Gumbo and was put together by the journalist and author Garth Cartwright, who was curious to know if New Orleans still held up to its reputation as one of the greatest music cities on earth. And the answer is, of course, a resounding yes. And so to the summer of WOMAD. Now, it's always difficult to hear everything you want to at these festivals. And this year, with WOMAD celebrating its 30th birthday, well, there just seem to be many more artists on my must-see list that, sadly, I missed. And Portugal's Deolinda was one of them. But hooray, I get to hear them now, as do you. They had the graveyard shift on the Saturday night in the Siam tent. Normally a time and place for tranquility and chill-out grooves. But with Deolinda, even if they sing fado, it's never going to be sedate and mournful. Here they are with their own brand of music and mischief.
Desculpem todos os homens estetos, espíritos poetas, almas delicadas, a falsidade do meu gênio, das minhas palavras. Que eu canto, que é da vida, o espanto, que é da bela graça. Mas eu sou ambicionar, contar batatas. Desculpem lá qualquer coisinha, mas não chega quem cantou o fado. Será para ouvir a linda, entraram no supermercado. Nós estamos numa casa ali ao lado, andamos todos uma casa ao nosso lado. Bem, fatulhas, escritores, letrados, estudadores e serventes, poetas e poetas que são verdadeiras pedreiras das letras e cantem arte. se apesca. Desculpem lá qualquer coisinha, mas não esteja quem tenta o fal. Se é para virar de um linda, entraram no sítio errado. É que nós estamos numa casa ao meu lado. Andamos todos uma casa ao nosso lado. Por não fazer o que mais gosto, conto com desgosto, o facto de tempo de estar. E alguns chega alguém mal disposto, ocupa o meu lugar. Ninguém está bem com o que tem, há sempre um cavalo que nos vai valer. Porém, posso sempre se alguém não é quem deve ser. Desculpem lá qualquer coisinha, mas não está cá quem cantou o fado. Se era para ouvir a de linda, entraram no sítio errado. É que nós estamos numa casa ao meu lado. Andamos todos uma casa ao nosso
territory for a perfectly good reason. You see, the next two songs we're going to play are inspired by Fado. We don't play Fado, but we are inspired by Fado. And, well, the next two songs are a great example of that inspiration. And back in the old days, in the Fado houses, the Fadistas used to sing behind the guitar players and the bass player. So, as a sort of a homage we pay to those old days and to those old and true fadistas, I'm here, invading male territory. Canção da tal guitarra.
Yeah.
e quero ser uma pessoa de corpo e alma, mulher daquela que me toca e me atrai. Sou eu quem mais vai sofrer por tantas outras, mas só a mim eu vim dizer, e sou eu quem eu consolo a noite toda. Desconsolo ao qual imploro não querer tocar a cantiga dessa tal amada que o ciúme desvarava a ponto de cantar. Mas quero o destino que eu mantenho ao tino, acato o destino, mas vingo bem. E eu desafino, toco e desafino, eu que sempre afino já desafinei. Mas quero o destino que eu mantenho ao tino, acato o destino, mas vingo bem. E eu desafino, toco e desafino, eu que sempre afino.
Anna Bacalhau, lead singer of Dear Linda, invading male territory, as she put it, at WOMAD this year. More delights from the festival still to come, including the amazing Azerbaijani singer Nazaket Temurova and Niger's very own desert rebel Abdallah Ombodougou. Now for a double scoop of indulgence. First up, popular electro beats composer and ex-Soap Kills band leader Zayed Hamdan and Awak, sung by Syrian Hiba Mansouri. Although Awak means I love you, it is a song about a love without hope. It was from an album called Radio Beirut that came out on the German label Galileo and was one of the many compilations that emerged during the long and turbulent Arab Spring.
Awak, só na minha onda, cê não vai me acompanhar. Eu sigo só, não quero sombra, nem ninguém pra me assombrar. Eu tô no dente da serpente, eu tô na jaula do leão, dançando na chapa quente do fogão. Vou sozinho em meu caminho, cê não vai me acompanhar. Só comigo cê não pode acompanhar. Essa estrada pra ninguém me acompanhar. Hora certa, madrugada, longe do seu doce lar. Tô na beira do acidente, tô na boca do vulcão, distante de toda gente que tem razão. Eu tô no dente da serpente, eu tô na jaula do leão, dançando na chapa quente do fogão. Sou mais um sobrevivente namorando a solidão.
Se não vai me acompanhar from an album that combines two great music nations, Mali and Brazil. Tumani Diabate and Brazilians Arnaldo Antunes and Edgar Scandura got together at the Back to Black Festival in Rio a couple of years ago and decided to collaborate on an album, A Curva da Cintura. It was released at the Back to Black Festival that was held at the old Billingsgate Market in London at the beginning of the summer. It's not for everyone, but what compels me to it is that I like where they're going with the mix of musics. It's an interesting path. And perhaps on their next album, and I do hope there is one, they will be that much closer to reaching their goal. And the session that those three did for Radio 3 in July was one of the highlights last year for World Roots. And what's sure to be a highlight of 2013 is coming up at the end of January. It's the launch of the next World Roots Academy. And you have a chance to come along to the launch. The event is on the 25th of January at 7:30 p.m. in the BBC Radio Theatre. And details of the ways in which you can apply for free tickets can be found on the World Roots page on the BBC website. Now, hammocked amongst the trees of the Arboretum at WOMAD, the Radio 3 stage is the perfect setting for Star Trek moments. And by that I mean being transported to another world. So when Nazaket Temurova walked onto the stage that Friday at 6 p.m, a time when the late afternoon gives up reluctantly to the evening, you knew you were heading off to another dimension. She's perhaps one of the best Azerbaijani female singers, and it's no wonder that she was awarded a UNESCO prize for the most beautiful voice last year. Here she is. Thank you. Morgam Hegrati from Nazaket Timurova, who graced our stage at WOMAD this year. Gonzaga Coutinho is a Goan musician, and earlier this year he brought out Shangri-La Goa on Arc Music. It's an album of traditional and popular songs from Goa, and I think it deserves to be heard again on the programme. Here he is taking us down memory lane with a track called Kedna, a traditional song he heard as a child amongst the Goan community in Mozambique, where he was born.
Kedna, oh Kedna, tungo yetel. Kuskentu jakaliz mojin sukon gogele Kedna go kedna tungu yatele Kuskentu jakaliz mojin sukon gogele
Koka kunye yere ni kopa no makake Moka kunye yere ni kopa no makake Moka kunye yere ni kopa no makake Moka kunye yere ni kopa no makake
Nito tembe lopuna Azunura tantuka, devuk zanantun kitak, makago sotaita, misanira fokotuzo, glas makaeta, ekturi pokurum nazar semestar gomaka, ekturi pokurum nazar semestar gomaka, kedna go kedna, tungo yetele, uskentu jakaliz mojin sukon gogele, kedna go kedna, tungo yetele. Kanto jacaliz mojin sukon gogele
Moka punye ye ni gopa no makake Moka punye ye ni gopa no makake Moka punye ye ni gopa no makake Moka punye ye ni gopa no makake
Your woman to boil some rice, big knuckle and rice tonight, big knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once and you want it twice, big knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once for you want it twice. Young lady, take my advice. sure you treat your husband nice. All you learn to boil the rice, pig knuckle and rice tonight. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once and you want it twice. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once for you want it twice. One morning, I woke up late. There was no knuckle upon my plate. But the thing that make me mad, the woman come with a bowl of shad. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once, boy, you want it twice. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once and you want it twice. At a Calypso party last Saturday night, people drinking and people tight. But the only thing could save a fight, pig knuckle and rice tonight. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once and you want it twice. Pig knuckle and rice tonight. You eat it once and you want it twice.
The delicious deep tones of Sydney Bean extolling the tastiness and man-pulling power of pig knuckles and rice. Not what I will be serving up for Christmas, however. What a great album from the guys at Frémaux. Witty, pithy storytelling in a double CD set dedicated to just Bermuda, that mysterious little British overseas territory that in the 50s was totally rocking to the sounds of Gombe and Calypso. If you want to know what the issues of the day were or the social mores of the time, all you have to do is listen to these songs. Now back for one last time to WOMAD, and this time music from Niger. Abdallah Umbadougou is a Tuareg from Niger, known as the Desert Rebel. Like his Malian cousins Tenariwen, he has put his experiences of exile, poverty and identity into his music. When he stood on the Radio 3 stage, last thing on the Saturday night, he turned the arboretum into a rich green oasis in the desert.
Hanzuar kagat na, Haitma den minna, Haitma den maraha, Haitma aratumas,
Haitma
den minna, Haitma den maraha, Haitma aratumas, Haitma den minna,
Haitma
den maraha,
Haitma.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Abdallah Umbadugu and a song there called Balas from his performance on the Radio 3 stage at WOMAD this summer. Well, that's it for tonight and for me from this year. So though it's early, I know, a happy Christmas to you all and also have a great new year. I'll be back on the 4th of January when my guests in the studio will be the Italians Nidi Darak. I hope you can join me then. Thanks for listening, and thanks also to all of my producers, Roger Short, James Parkin and Felix Carey, and the rest of the Radio 3 team. Next week, Marianne Kennedy will be sharing with you more memories from WOMAD. In the new year, World Roots will be bringing their own tribute to Ravi Shankar in two programmes due to go out in January. So for tonight, I leave you with a final tribute from World on Three to Ravi Shankar, a man who the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, described as a national treasure and global ambassador of India's cultural heritage. This is Ravi Shankar with his longtime tabla accompanist, yet another legend of India's classical music history, Ala Raka Khan and Rag Kamaj. Till we meet in the new year, goodbye.
Hello and welcome to Through the Night on BBC Radio 3 with me, Katriona Young. Three Czech cello concertos take us through the next couple of hours, along with a Mozart divertimento and one of Schubert's last string quartets. Karl Stamitz was working in Europe at the same time as the young Mozart was trying to make his own reputation there and clearly saw Stamitz as a rival. He called him a wretched scribbler of music, although in fact Stamitz was extremely popular and the public flocked to his concerts. He did fall out of fashion in the end, though, and when his manuscripts were auctioned after his death, there wasn't a single buyer. He wrote this concerto for the cello-playing King of Prussia.